Republican Senator Dale Schultz of Richland Center announced today he will not be seeking re-election. Senator Schultz first came to the Capitol as an assembly member. He was elected in 1982, so it's been 31 years, but who's counting? Dale, you look like there's a little weight off your shoulders here. I mean, you've made a decision. You toyed with seeking re-election as a Republican, as an independent. How you feel?
Well, I feel relieved. There's been a lot of pressure on me to, you know, reveal something, which necessitated struggling, you know, in my own mind with the things that are important to me. And once you make a decision, life is always easier.
Well, let's talk about those decisions. You chose not to seek re-election when you would have faced a primary. Could you have won that primary?
I don't think there's any doubt in my mind, and it had very little to do with whether or not I ran or not. You know, I got to tell you a cute story that's true. You've been at my farm. We've done some taping there. You know where the sink is.
I've met your dogs. I know where your sink is.
Yep. I came home one day when I sort of decided I was going to run for the legislature. My wife was standing at the kitchen sink peeling potatoes, and I, you know, burst through the door. Hi, honey. You know, she kept her head down, said hi, honey, and just kept at her work. And I said, what do you think about me running for the legislature? She calmly put down the potato, put down her peeler, put her hands on her hips, turned, looked right at me, and very sternly said, I always knew you'd do this to me. Run and get it out of your system. We hadn't been married a year.
Wow.
And, you know, during the intervening time, she has been the most amazing woman in the world and the center of my life. She's been a great mother. She has been an outstanding professional educator, has made a difference in a lot of families and kids' lives in southwestern Wisconsin, and she's been a great life partner. And I think at some point, when you have a relationship like that, it's important to demonstrate it, not just to her, but to just drink deeply and to take some time with them. You know, a lot of people say, well, you're being put out to pasture, you know, you're you know, going to retire. Look, I'm as vital and energized as I ever have been. I'm just trying to get a sense of priorities. My family and kids and wife mean the world to me. And this will give me a little more time to spend with them and allow me to do some things with them that I might not have been able to do. But as far as winning, I think I could have won as a Republican. I think I would have had an easier time winning as a independent because I would have done one election rather than two.
Yeah.
But, you know, that just, it wasn't all that important. I've stood for election 12 times. By the end of this term, it will be 32 years in office. I have been active in politics for 49 years, and I hope I'm active for many more years. And exactly what route that will take, I don't know, but I'm clearly leaving the door open. And that may mean another run for office, and it may not. And like J.B. Van Hollen, I think anybody with an open, inquisitive mind who loves people and loves government, that's always will be intriguing. But is it essential to leading a complete life that I run again? No. So take that for what it's worth and nothing more. I'm just excited about the future and what comes next. My good friend Bo Ryan is fond of telling his players, don't worry about the last game, worry about the next game, what you're going to do in the future. And that's sort of where I'm focused.
I would have found it intriguing for you to run as an independent because it would have been low budget. And you mentioned Bill Proxmire-type campaign. We haven't seen that in decades. That must have intrigued you, or was that just not winnable?
No, I you know, as a student of history, it certainly intrigued me. But, you know, again, I didn't spend a lot of time dwelling on whether I was going to win or not. I was suddenly faced 2 weeks into this legislative session with a state representative who'd served one term who decided he was going to primary me. And that begged a question, are you going to run for re-election? Last couple times I've run, I've wrestled with it. I've sat down and discussed this with my family and friends, as I've told you guys in the media for the, you know, last year. And I wasn't going to lie and beat around the bush or something. I just was quite honest about it, saying I had made up my mind. And it occurred to me, it was a little strange that 2 weeks into a legislative session with a budget staring us in the face, that I had this brand new assemblyman who was more interested in running for higher office than being engaged in a budget. And I thought, well, if I do decide to run, I'd like to have a stark contrast, and it would mean that I wouldn't have to worry about campaigning. So I said quite clearly, I'm not going to get baited into a race prematurely and lose focus on what people sent me there to do. And I think it has drawn a stark contrast throughout my district. That's what my constituents have told me. And, you know, people aren't dumb. They're smart. They're really smart. And I think they want people who will represent them. And I've worked very hard this session to not only be engaged before the budget got to me, to be engaged when it came, and to be engaged when the governor was considering his vetoes. And, you know, I'm pleased with, you know, my impact on the process. I didn't get everything I wanted, but I think I represented my constituents pretty well, and I think my constituents can see that, and I say that with some confidence because that's what they've told me.
I'm not smart enough to be a pundit, but some of the pundits will say you were Tea Partied out of this office. Respond.
Oh, you know, I think that there are a lot of people want to call politics as a horse race, and there's nothing I can do about that other than to tell you what I feel and what I know. And I've done that all along and been open and as transparent as I can about it. Do I have feelings about the Tea Party? Sure I do. Do I have feelings about the state of the body politic in the post-Citizens United era? Absolutely. We have an ocean of money that has flowed into the process that is entirely opaque. We don't know who it is that's putting this money in, what their motivations are, and it allows them to essentially buy the public square. As a Republican who considers himself pro-business, I've never thought that business shouldn't be a part of the discussion in the public square. But I have never thought that business should own it. And I think that it's fine that people, you know, want to enter into the process, whatever they want to call themselves. My view, though, is we'll get further by working together in a constructive manner than all the destructive things we've seen. I've been telling people the last few days I happened to catch a tape of Glenn Beck on Joe Scarborough's program in the morning that was just astounding. You know, everybody knows Glenn Beck is this bombastic character who has just been throwing gasoline on every fire for a number of years. And somebody had apparently asked him, you know, what he thought about his career. And he was kind of hunched back and looking, maybe contrite is not the right word, but he was pensive. And he said, you know, I wish that I had been more of a uniter than a divider, or something akin to that, and that I'd never realized how fragile, I think he was talking about our society or our country is. And I look with some regret and lament what's happened in the last few years as we've developed this professional industry with all of the money that it's awash in the process now, these scab pickers of the carnage of our Great Recession, and the pain that it has caused people, the descendants of this mean-spirited fog of discourse that has so waylaid us from, you know, as Ronald Reagan would say, that rendezvous with destiny. And I sense as I go about my district, people are tired of it and they are looking for change. And I think change is coming, and I think Glenn Beck's comments are an indication of that. Of course, on Glenn Scarborough, they were discussing whether he meant it or it was just another stunt. And Glenn's comments were what they were, and Joe Scarborough said, well, I've taken him at his word, I know him. And I think somebody else says it really doesn't matter because it's a good point. And, you know, Tim Cullen and I have tried very hard this last session to demonstrate to the new people that there's a different way for this business to operate. And nothing is more powerful than a good example. And I think we've connected with an awful lot of people. And we've done it in a constructive way.
Contrast the Senate that you joined in 1991 with the Senate of 2014.
Well, when I first came here, there were people who were friends on both sides of the aisle. They enjoyed each other apart from the business. It was pretty rough and tumble. The good old days had their share of fights, there's no doubt about it, but it was commonplace to see legislators enjoying dinner in each other's company after a day in the legislature. There was never any effort to isolate or punish legislators who had friends on the other side of the aisle. And now we seem to have this process where you are immediately suspect if you're seen talking to somebody on the other side of the aisle. I had an interesting conversation with Congressman Pocan, you know, one night in the airport in Washington, Ronald Reagan, and I was coming and he was going, and he and I, you know, were talking about sort of the state of politics, and he just said, it's worse out here. They gather you in, and he was talking with great pride about having joined Reed Ribble and Tim Petrae and the Solutions Caucus, because that's what he was all about. And I share that feeling. I mean, I don't care whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, independent or whatever. It seems to me we're here to represent the people. At least that's the way I always thought it was. And that we should have as a common goal, doing the best for people that we can. And when we stray from that, we're not serving people well. And that's the big difference that I see.
Is being a moderate or being willing to work with across the aisle a death sentence now in politics?
Well, I don't know if it's a death sentence, but it certainly attracts an awful lot of money and harsh criticism, but it also attracts a lot of admirers who know how difficult it is to stand up on your own and think through things and articulate them. You know, I've told people who, you know, wonder about how am I coping with what's going on, I said, well, come and spend a day with me and see how people react to me. I have never felt more loved and appreciated in my whole political career in the last few years, and I say that because I am reminded literally on a daily basis by people I don't even know who take the time to come up to me, and it is indeed humbling.
Where is the party of Abe Lincoln headed given the rightward shift, Senator?
Well, I think that's a whole night and a case of beer, my friend. let me just say, I am proud to say that.
Give me the six-pack version.
I am proud to be a part of that grand old party that traces its roots to Abraham Lincoln, reveres the service of Teddy Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower and Ronald Reagan. What am I talking about? Think about the humanity of Abraham Lincoln and his desire for equality and justice for all in this country. Think about Teddy Roosevelt's love for the environment and, you know, his unflagging leadership.
That Teddy Roosevelt,
who's not incidentally a shield. That's an inspiration.
Okay, excuse me for interrupting.
I wonder what these two gentlemen would think about. You know, Dwight Eisenhower was a guy who campaigned to make it easier for people to vote. And while he certainly respected the ballot box, he understood that our country is strongest when more people have a chance to participate, not less. He's a person who believed in investing in the infrastructure of this country and its importance to our future. The interstate highway system is largely in place because of his visionary leadership. He was a builder, not a destroyer. And then think about Ronald Reagan. A man with a unique capacity, with a smile and a gentle handshake, to be able to sit down with people who are diametrically opposed to him, like Tip O'Neill, to do what's needed and what's best for the country, like save Social Security. Where have we strayed from this as Republicans? I don't know, but I'll tell you what, I'm doing my best to hoist the flag for those guys who've been heroes for me.
I think you just said Ted Cruz is not the future of the party that you've been a part of for 49 years.
Well, you know, we've sort of had this Anschluss with Dixiecrats, and to me, I don't want those four heroes of mine to be replaced by George Wallace, Lester Maddox, Ted Cruz, or Michelle Bachmann. And while I'm all for a big tent, I don't see the ideas that these four and four represent being reconciled.
When did partisanship become the operating norm in the Capitol, and who do you blame for it?
Oh, I think all of us have a piece of the blame. Each time that we fail to stand up and yell bullshit when somebody does something, it means that it belongs to all of us. I think that people who have failed to consider the interests of the process and the general welfare of all, and put that above their own self-interest that might be an immediate gain in an election, have something to blame. So I'll put myself in that category too. But the real question is not what happened in the last game, it's what are we going to do going forward? And I'm encouraged at the progress I've seen in recent weeks about redistricting. I heard the other day that the governor was in Beloit and said he'd sign redistricting reform if it got to his desk, and I believe that's a true statement. If not, I'll apologize in advance. But now it's time, to apply even more pressure and to ask people to stand up and do what's fundamentally right for all of us. Legislators should not pick their own constituents. Constituents should pick them. In this day and age with computer technology, it's literally possible to give every member of the legislature a bulletproof district. And I don't think our founding fathers had that in mind as a principle that they wanted to see inculcated in government. And just because you have the authority to be in charge and do something doesn't mean the manner in which you're going about it is the right thing.
You brokered some tough deals and took some tough votes in 31 years. Was Act 10 the toughest? And I say that because I still remember the time I came to the front door of this office and there was a sign, "This is closed because of threats."
Mm-hmm.
Act 10 the toughest?
Well, you know, we had to put that note on our door because we were instructed to do it. I never felt unduly threatened by people on either side. I look out at the crowd and I'd look at the faces in my district at meetings, and I saw an awful lot of friends and neighbors who were under a great deal of distress. And the potential for something horrible to happen was certainly there. And that concerned me a lot, and I think I articulated that about as well as I thought I could. It was a very difficult issue. Was I going to do what I knew would be good for me politically, or was I going to represent my constituents? I literally went out night after night in my district and faced crowds of 500-600 people in community after community, open to anyone, with a microphone where people got a chance to come forward and say what they had to say. And I took notes. And when everybody had a say, then I stood up and did my best to respond to individuals where it was meaningful, and to respond to common concerns. And then I said to people, "I'll hang around here and answer whatever questions you have or follow up with you, within reason," because I had to go back to work the next day. And it was clear to me, after having gone through that, that I was on the right track, offering an alternative, recognizing it was necessary for a reset, but also listening carefully and thoughtfully to what my constituents have to say, and then reflecting it. That's what I always thought the process was about, and that was hard. But, you know, there have been a lot of hard decisions over the years. I would go to meetings over the lower Wisconsin Riverway, and they were as close to riots as anything you can imagine. People throwing things and turning red face and turning on their neighbor and the like. We got through it. We got through it because Governor Tommy Thompson provided tremendous leadership. Dick Kruel and I worked to pull together local officials and develop an alternative so that we could have an honest discussion and a real compromise. There was enough wisdom on the other side of the aisle, and I'll mention Spencer Black because he was a big part of the drive to do this, but there were many others who I think wanted to see what they viewed as, you know, progress and their ideas moving forward, but they were respectful of those of us who represented the area. Now, after some two decades and some time, we have become a international model. I think the vast majority of people not only have accepted the Lower Wisconsin Riverway, they've embraced it. Land values have gone up, and we in the region basically control the process through the governing board that was a part of that legislation. Very difficult time, very emotional time, but it was something that I remember. I remember when recycling, speaking of Spencer Black, was made an issue. You were here.
I covered that debate.
And I sat in the back at the table, a pretty new legislator, being part of the negotiations. And, you know, in those days, that was a controversial issue. These days, you know, people go, what do you mean recycling? Everybody recycles, don't they? Well, in those days, it was a hot topic. And we got through it. And it wasn't just the recycling that was important. At the same time, I had a friend who was was a new acquaintance at that point, who was coming to my district, wanted to open a plastic plant, and told me in no uncertain terms how important it was that we do this right, and that it be based on science, and that it be workable. And he wasn't against recycling, he just needed stability. And we managed to satisfy that. He created hundreds of jobs in my district, was hugely successful. And to me, as I look back, you know, those difficult times when you know, you have to search your soul and formulate your own opinions are what make you. And when you have to do that alone, you know, if you can survive, as they say, it only makes you stronger. And that's what I sort of feel has been special about the last few years.
You mentioned two things you're proudest of. Is there anything else in your record that, that you're proud of?
Well, it's the funny
short list.
That would be, you know, perhaps regarded as the most important thing I've ever had a chance to be involved in. And I say that in all humility because I'm not the only person who was engaged. Private citizens and many of my colleagues worked on it. It's right behind you up on top of that cabinet there. And that's being the person who was able to sign into law the, you know, the agreement for the existence of Wisconsin Eye. And I, and I understand now there's a quarter million people watching Wisconsin Eye. Is that correct?
I'm not up on the number, but let me ask you this. Wisconsin Eye signed on in May of 2007. What difference has it made?
Well, there's no doubt about it. People are watching, and they're holding me and my colleagues accountable. You can be in a committee meeting and, you know, your staff comes up with a note, somebody's been watching and they're saying, what is going on there? You know, don't you understand this or that? Or, great job, I really appreciated it. Or, Dale, leave the flowered tie at home, you look terrible, wear stripes. You know, the fact of the matter is it's the world's greatest tool for accountability for the citizens of this state. And I certainly hope that people are encouraging their friends and neighbors to watch. I certainly tell them, and I also tell them that if you like what you see, for heaven's sakes, recognize this isn't a government operation. Send in a donation. You know, it's the smartest investment in good government you'll ever make. And I tell them they can pull things out of the archives so they can know the history of things, and they do. Or you can watch in real time. You don't have to take a day off to come to Madison and get frustrated while you sit there while you watch legislators eat their lunch or something, for heaven's sake. So that, for you know, for me, is a legacy that I will always be proud of.
Well,
and you, my friend, have done an outstanding job of making the other programming that Wisconsin Eye does professional, intelligent, and that serves the public well.
But I'm interviewing you. So my next question is, what advice do you have for Representative Mark Lyne?
Well, it would be the same advice that I gave him when he started, whether he remembers it or not. You know, listen to the people. I grew up in a family. My dad was a pharmacist for over 50 years, retail. He always told me, Dale, the customer's always right. And if you listen to them and give them what they want, and it can explain what you've done. In this business where you seek to sell hope, you will do very, very well. And, you know, I know after spending the time I've spent that he couldn't have been more wrong about the two issues he identified when he decided to primary me. And I know that if he was listening, he would have heard the concern of everybody who cares about public education in southwestern and south central Wisconsin, and he would have heard the concerns of everybody who's involved in the healthcare community. Certainly, you know, these are times of change, and we all need to work hard to think about each other and bring each other along and have an equally bright future.
Okay, I only have a couple more questions. What advice would you give Governor Walker?
Well, you know, I instead of giving him advice, why don't you let me give him a compliment?
Okay.
Last week, I sent him a letter asking him to declare a state of emergency. This weekend, he did that. For that, I am grateful. Last week, he said that there was no role for the state to play a role. There, you know, money wasn't going to make a difference. After making the decision to convene a stakeholders group, as I'd also recommended, I think he was had grown enough to recognize that sometimes you have to change your mind. And this morning he announced to the media that he would make $1 million available for the short term a week, and then $7 million in the second week, because he suddenly saw there was a need. What, you know, what need are we talking about? People who depend on fuel assistance, who might freeze to death in minus 50 degree weather. People who might lose their business because they couldn't get financing are also a concern, though. And so as long as the governor's willing to keep an open mind and discuss these issues with the legislature, he will do well, and I will be a good partner for him. But as I am fond of telling governors, I don't work for them. I work for a separate branch of government. And when we have the debate over his tax proposal, I hope that he will respect the legislature and that he will keep an open mind, because I'm hearing a very different thing than he is. And maybe hopefully working together, we can leave everybody in this state with a smile on their face, feeling like they have been heard.
You wouldn't vote for his tax cuts if it were up today, sir?
Well, what I would say is that I'm still listening to my constituents. I've spent a great deal of time in the last weeks out there listening, and what I'm hearing is a crystal clear thread that is like this. Get rid of our structural deficit. We liked it when you did it with the first budget in this Walker administration. Pay our bills. Give us some stability so that we can plan for the future. And that means you don't have to spend or send every dollar out the door. You're only, for heaven's sake, 6 months into a new budget. Put a little money in the rainy day fund, and then people will tell me the two most of what they would like to see money spent on, and the two most popular items are our roads and our schools. And I would hasten to add, now given this crisis that has loomed over the shortage of propane, that I hope we could find it in our hearts to remember that we are our brother's keeper. And for this son of a preacher man, I hope that he remembers that.
I just have two more questions. Number one, I'm just guessing here, having covered you for only 26 years, I think the biggest thing you regret not getting done is wider broadband and internet service to your rural district. Am I anywhere close?
Oh, I think you know me well, and it's been a huge issue for me. You know, I told people about the 4 for 14, you know, jobs in poverty, and what I was talking about for jobs and the ultimate ability for us to allow the people in rural areas who are suffering economically to join the mainstream and the good life in the future that's ahead, is the need to have the tools necessary to be a part of global commerce, and that's broadband. I lately have been telling audiences a story, a real story that came in here. A woman moved from New York City to a small community in my district, and she had the opportunity to telecommute. And she's living temporarily in a small community, and it's going fine. And the ultimate goal for her husband and her was to move on the family farm. And when it came time to doing that, lo and behold, she discovered broadband wasn't available. Now, there's an opportunity that, you know, is directly linked to a job. In fact, it's a story that could be told over and over again, and I can't tell you right now whether or not she's worked it out or what she's going to do. But that's a story, a real story, that resonates with me. And it's why broadband is important. And you bet, for the bulk of this term, I'm going to continue to do everything I can to be as strong a voice for investment in broadband. We have a lot of good commercial partners who have made progress. It's a competitive business, and you know there are limitations to what they can do. But ultimately, none of us can rest until everyone has the tools necessary to compete in this great global economy that's upon all of us.
And then finally, I was surprised when you told Channel 3 that you would consider running for Congress, and I was surprised because you did that in 2000.
Well, I tell people I did pretty well. I came in second.
You got 43%, I think. Are you serious? If Kine runs for the U.S. Senate in 2016?
Look.
Because wouldn't you be criticized by the same batch of conservatives and those raising money under Citizens United who are backing Representative Markline?
Well, let me just say that that same question was posed to our Attorney General who's leaving office. And he said, of course I'd consider it. Nobody who's motivated by people and ideas like folks who find their way to this business are as being honest when they say they wouldn't consider it. Of course I'd consider it. Would my life be deemed by me to be incomplete if I didn't run? No, I don't think that's the case. I think that's the honest answer. Who can knows what the future will bring? But being flexible and available, sometimes there are opportunities there. And I'm not leaving here, beaten down and, never again wanting to participate. I have enjoyed immensely my opportunities here, and particularly the last few years. They haven't always been easy, but they have provided for me enormous rewards.
And on that note, Republican Senator Dale Schultz, thanks for the long, candid discussion. I really appreciate it.
You bet, Steve. I always enjoy
31
seeing
years.
You. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
And I'll do my part to make sure that the listenership, viewership continues to grow.
Senator, thanks very much.
You bet.
Thanks.